online. And what's your name?
I am David Rose. I was born in 1916.
And where were you born?
I was born in Pendleton, Oregon.
In Pendleton. When did you move to the La Grande area?
1918.
Uh-huh. And how old were you at that time?
And a half, 3 years old.
Uh-huh. And you moved to Starkey? Or?
Moved to Starkey, Oregon. There used to be lots of sheep out this in that country, you know, and there was everybody had saddle horses and pack animals. And my mother run the post office there at Starkey and had some grocery store too.
And that was at the Starkey store where they called Starkey.
That was the old Starkey store.
Uh-huh. Well, so many people are confused. When you say Starkey, they think Mount Emily Camp, Starkey?
No. There wasn't even any Mount Emily Camp there at all.
It was just where the store was.
And there wasn't any logging in there at all. It was just, like I said, it was sheep outfits, cattle, and that sort of thing.
And that's the line of work your father?
My dad had a ranch there, and he had run cattle and horses and grain, wheat.
Then when you got up to the age that you would go to school, where did you go to school?
First, I can remember going to school. I went to school to this old school up there at Starkey. And then after we left there, we moved down around into the Pendleton country, and I went to school down there.
Uh-huh. When you started to school at Starkey, was that a one or two?
Oh, just a one-room school with maybe a... I don't know, 10, 12 kids, pupils.
Uh-huh.
One teacher from all.
That was 1 through 8th grade?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Uh-huh. Then you moved back to Pendleton, and how long did you stay there?
Oh, we stayed there. I left Pendleton and came up into La Grande when I was about 24 years old. I went railroading. That's the one to go railroading, so I had to come to La Grande to go railroading.
This was being the division point of the railroad.
Yeah. I first hired out on the Oregon Short Line.
Uh-huh.
And I really didn't like that because I hired out as a brakeman. And I wanted to hire out as a fireman, see.
Uh-huh.
So when I found out I might be able to hire out here in La Grande, I came over and first thing I did was I got acquainted with a couple of engineers, and they took me over and they hired me.
Good.
Yeah, and that was, I think it was 1940.
When you started out railroading, that was when they were using coal.
They used coal and oil.
Uh-huh.
They had the O'Malley type engines and then some lighter engines. They called them Mikes and other.
What series were those?
These were a freight engine, of course.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think the Mallee would, running up the mountain single, I don't think they'd take over 1,400 ton.
Uh-huh.
Had many more than that. They had a helper, sometimes two helpers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when you start working for the railroad, ask you a little bit, did they...
Yeah, they showed you where the peg was on the steam gauge, and they said that that's where they like to run it from when there was right on about that peg. Of course, if you got one of them too hot and they popped off, they was mad then too. And some of them was real cranky, but some of them was real good guys. Yeah, most of them, in fact, were just nice guys.
They had a little prestige in those days as being an engineer.
Oh, you better believe it. Yeah. They would show you how, when you first started, didn't show you how to hand fire an engine.
Uh-huh.
And but that's about the only time they ever picked up a scoop shovel was when they showed you where to do it. After that, you handled the scoop shovel.
Well, there's a lot more running an engine than just putting coal in it. And And
oh, yes, yes. Yeah, a lot more. Of course, those days, you know, you didn't get over the road very fast either. If you went to La Grande to Reith, you could do it in 10 hours. You made a pretty good trip.
Uh-huh.
Later on, you know, we got so we'd run La Grande to Reith in 2 hours and 35 minutes or something. These big diesel engines. We run both ways out of here.
Both ways.
Unless you bid a job in, which at those days, I didn't bid any jobs in because I was on an extra board.
Uh-huh.
So I was liable to be called either on the East End or West End. They just called you for an extra, some fireman laid off. Well, you got called whether it was East or West or whether it was just a helper or what it was.
Well, about how long did you work as a fireman before you became an engineer?
Well, in 1941, I went into the military.
Uh-huh.
And I done a 4-year stretch. When I come back, those other men was already promoted around me. So I had to do all the studying, or I was going to lose a lot of seniority.
Uh-huh.
So I studied to beat hell and passed all the examinations. In those days, you had to take a diesel examination and also steam engines. So it was a lot more to it than it would be now. Yeah, it was a rough go. It had to pass an inspection because it went through the government.
Mm-hmm.
See, federal inspection. You had to do it so good or...
Well, the engineer's responsibility on a train isn't just a hold of the throttle and you had to know how many cars you had.
Well, you knew, yes, you had to know how many cars and, yeah, the weight.
How did you determine those things?
Well, the conductor had the weigh bills and they would give you a message on for the yardmaster would tell you you're leaving here with 3,800 ton or 4,000 ton or whatever it was, and you knew the type of engines you had and how many, and you knew what the 4,000 ton with four of those big jacks that you're going to go single.
Now, what do you mean by single?
No helper.
Oh, no. Okay.
That's what I meant.
I understand now.
Yeah. Then later on, of course, we got those remote, we called them slave trains, and we was ordered not to call them slave units, and they was run off a radio system and nobody on them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But you controlled those as
you controlled them right there on the switchboard right there in front of you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So many people don't realize that for now.
Oh, yes. So if you take a big, heavy train and it would be a mile unless you just went right into emergency, and then you'd go a long ways. I run through a band of sheep one time down below North Fork. I think the sheep belonged to Hoskins. And they come around there on the forwarder train. Those are the fast freight. Come around there, and there'd been snow on the side of the hills. There was white patches around, and I looked down the track, and there was this white patch down there in the track, and I thought it was the edge of the track, and it was snow, until I saw the light hit them right. I see the reflection off of their eyes, and I run through a band of sheep. It was bedded down right on there, and I killed 78 head. Yeah. And I know that the rear of the train was past the sheep when they got stopped.
Yeah. Of course, then you always had...
Then you had to make out a report. Was the whistle blowing? Was the bell ringing? Of course, hell, I didn't know if I'd ring the bell or blew the whistle. It didn't make any difference. It was the middle of the night, a bunch of sheep on the track. I just went to an emergency and run through the sheep.
Well, oftentimes these inspectors would put out fusees or torpedoes, and you had to stop.
That's what they called a test.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, if it's just two torpedoes, you reduced your speed down. And if it's you reduced your speed, there might be a red flag setting up the track. If it did, you had to stop for it and to check it out. is just test. And that's all some of those officials had to do, was going out there to try to fire some guy, and some guy making an honest living.
To see you followed the rules to the letter.
Right.
It, in the early days when you got a lineup or something from the operators at these little depots, and they had a hoop out there. And
So you went by, you just scooped it up, hooked it over your arm, yeah.
And that told you what to do, but later on they put radios on the train.
Oh, it was all radioed and the central train control.
And you worked then, talked to the dispatcher?
Right to the dispatcher. You talked to the dispatcher, and he could tell you.
He didn't have to tell you.
If you'd get a flashing yellow light, and then you get the yellow light, and the next one around was either going to be a double red or a red over yellow, and the red over yellow was you take the passing track. And that's the way it is. You went into the passing track, right down to the other end, you stopped, and you stayed there until they cleared it.
Well, the which was the hardest to go? West to Reith or east to Huntington with the mountains?
West, going west to Reith. Steeper hill and heavier curves and more break-in twos. And you know, these big diesels, you know, you want to, they get the slip a few times and they can walk right through it to pull a drawbar out or break a knuckle.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're
Now, would you explain drawbar so that people that don't know about that, what it'd be?
Well, you know, like a glide hand where that's where the knuckles and everything close together and put it in. Well, the drawbar is up, went clear back into the car.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd like to pull one of them out, break one of them out, or a lot of times just you break a knuckle. If you was lucky, you just broke a knuckle. Because you pulled a drawbar. If you got a drawbar, then you had to chain up and take that car and wherever you could get it off in the passing track
off
or someplace.
Off to the siding or someplace.
Yeah,
there.
Then you had to go back and get your train.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, a lot of paint dangling around.
Wire?
Wire or just any place to set a car out. Yeah, I think you set a car out. If you had to set an engine out, I hit a carload of 2x4s one time when we were running into Napa, and that's fast track over there, and we used to run some of them 65, 70 miles an hour. Right out in front of me, and I hit this. Of course, I had an emergency quite a ways before I got to it because I saw he stalled on the track. And I had to set the engine out. And they got hurt. So we had to set that unit out. Ordinarily, though, a lot of those trees and many more got up where there's three or four A units, and an A unit is a control unit. You could switch it on and...
On
the curves.
How did you determine that?
Well, it's on the degree of the curve.
Uh-huh.
And you notice, we never paid too much attention on the degree of the curve because of the sign up there. The sign was 30 miles an hour. Of course, you knew your railroad anyway, and you already knew that. Of course, you've run over it a few times. Why? It was... Watch.
So you experienced as a fireman, and then were able to handle it when you became a full-fledged engineer.
But there's quite a bit on your mind. You had the responsibility, and you had to watch out for. I was always worried to death that I'd hit some woman with a bunch of kids in the car going to school, especially the last few years I worked over on the Idaho, like I said, was fast track and lots of crossings. And it was quite a worry.
I can appreciate
it. Yeah. I hit several cars. Don't think I ever killed anybody. They'd pull right up and you know, that seems to be like they'd pull you up and they'd seem to take their foot off the brake and the car would roll into you. I don't understand how they could do that, but the other idea anyway, you should stop back a ways because Those trains going by pretty fast. What if a brake shoe would fly off of there and hit you pretty near go through an automobile if you're doing about 60 miles an hour with a freight train, one of them big brake shoes come off? Yeah, I'd step back a little ways. It's a... Railroading was a very interesting job, a lot more so than a lot of people realize. They thought all you had to do was get on there and blow the whistle and ring the bell and open the throttle.
Well, those were the questions we wanted you to help
There's
answer.
There's just a hell of a lot more to it than that. You had air brakes. A lot of people figure that when you set the brakes, you added air. Well, you didn't add any air. You took it up. You had 90 pounds. You draw it down to 20 pounds. You set 20 pounds of air. Air brakes. Well, you set the brakes on the train. You had to release the brakes on your drivers, on your engine. Because if you're working power and set a little air, you do that a lot of times because it kept your slack running in and out.
And the slack could make it bang.
That's right. If you want to be a smooth train handler, you took a little pride in that sort of thing. Yeah, the railroad was quite a job. It the hours was terrible. It's like hell. They worked any hour of the night or day. You could get called any night or time or day. But
and you never had a holiday at home.
Oh no, not it's, no. You could you work Christmas and whatnot, didn't it? But you expected it. And they did pay you damn well, especially the last few years you worked. It was a big, good-paying job. The hours was terrible. The pay was real good. You could support your family and own a decent home. And when you got ready to retire, if you had any sense, you had a few dollars saved, and they retired you well. You get a decent pension, and your supplemental insurance and whatnot would help a great deal.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah. The medicines now, I had a light stroke about 3-4 months ago. And so now I take Plethix. And it cost $119 for 30 pills. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And I take no Medicare. I am allowed $1,700 on my insurance will pay that, but I have to pay $15 for each prescription. And then I have to pay for the medicine, but $1,900, and then I have to pay for it.
Yeah. Well, that is a help.
Oh, marvelous.
Now, when you were working, did you ever get on to work?
Oh, yeah, that was, you did. You knew you was going to get called the next morning. Yeah.
And how did your run go up the branch?
Pretty slow. Track wasn't all that good, and it was very crooked. And but there wasn't any central train controller passing tracks. You wasn't going to meet anybody. If it was aboard an Ed, it would be a speeders or a section crew, and they'd be off out of your road anyway.
Did you go up in one day and come back the same day, or did you
no.
emotionally go up one
you
day?
You went
back
up
the
one
next?
Day and come back the next.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times you was 12, 14, 15 hours making that one trip because you had all the switching to do. And then coming back, why, you just picked up.
Uh-huh.
Picked up your cars that you switched out. And usually come back in, 9 hours. It was... I took that job because I got tired of the extra board. Otherwise, I wouldn't have took it. As soon as I could get off of it, I took a mainline job as a regular crew member.
But it paid pretty good, didn't it?
Oh, yes. It paid real good. Yeah. Paid good.
Then you kind of knew what you were doing.
You did. You knew what time you were going to call. And if they didn't call you, you got paid anyway.
Uh-huh.
You got 100 miles paid. But ordinarily, you didn't miss me.
Up down at Looking Glass.
Oh, yeah, a lot of fishermen.
Fish.
And yeah, we'd haul them down, and we'd pick them up, and which would have been frowned on, but we did it. We picked them up and let them off, and it didn't cost them nothing. when they first went out there, why, they used to have a baggage car, and they would, I think they had to pay when they rode that, but the other one, they got rid of that. Why, we just pick them up and then tell them, get back on a unit there and tend to your own business, don't bother anything. And one of the other A unit, and that was A, would be one of the control units, would be in the back, or if you didn't have one, why, they just ride in the cab with you and let them off where they wanted to. Yeah.
That was a great time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's a lot of steelhead fishermen, trout fishermen, and their whole camp outfit and everything else, take them down below around down, stop down there and let them off.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, didn't ask anybody. Yeah, and the section crews up on a job like that were different too than they were on the main line. They were killing everything because they practically had to be, see. Because any problems, you tell them where it was. You had a bad piece of track so-and-so or this or that. Why, you tell them, you better say hi.
I had worked for Sylvan when I was timekeeper and material
clerk. Yeah, good guy.
For the railroad.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I can't remember. What the hell was his last name? Can't remember his last name now. That was a good job, although the mainline job was a lot better job. It paid more. You know, an engineer got paid by the weight on the drivers.
Mm-hmm.
A one unit paid you a lot less, quite a bit less than four or five or six of those big engines, those big jacks. I called them jacks. And paid by the hundred. You also got terminal delay. If you was delayed too long in the terminal, they had to start paying you. And things like that, you know. Yeah, it was it. I remember when one time my son got, he was just a kid going to high school, he bought me one of those little, not a computer, but a
thing machine.
Calculator. And I told him, I said, well, I don't know whether I want that or not. I said, in 3 months, I'll be another idiot. I want to know how to figure my time with a pencil. And it made it so much easier, you know. But, and by the way, you kept a time book, your time down. You kept a time book. And if you could figure your pay within $5 or $6, you was brilliant. Just couldn't be done. So much weight drivers and this and that and different things. So I used to work at it real close a few times. Now, railroading's a, you have to be born to really make a good railroader. It's got to be with you. Because I saw the time, a lot of times I sat on the edge of a bed, I'd get called, maybe only been in bed about 3 hours, and get called to go back out, and think, why in the hell don't I quit? And then I get to thinking about Evelyn and the two kids, and I'd get up and go to work. Well, those railroaders are used to working nights. They're used to it. You don't get used to working nights because you're going to be working nights. And you'll change back into days and work and forth. No, don't get used to that. It's used to be a lot of men that work here at the roundhouse. Lots of men and car inspectors and later on when they got central train control, diesel trains, there was very few. There was no roundhouse. The fact they'd done away with it and even tore it down, you know that.
It's sad to look over in the yard.
Yeah, it is. And, yeah. And, got a lot of men out of work.
True.
But that's the way big companies end. You hear people talk about, cuss the unions. When you work for a big company like a railroad, you better belong to a good union. I belong to the engineers, of course, and you'd better, because One man can't contest an organization like that.
And then you had to have job insurance.
Oh, I had job insurance. I had so much job insurance, I laughed one time. They was just kept turning the light red. We was trying to switch some cars, and I got mad, and I decided, I just went on through it, back and forth through it. And I got through, I called the dispatcher, and I said, well, I asked you about that light. I said, well, he said, you treated it like a clear one. He said, must have been clear. And I said, yeah. And I said, he said, besides that, I had an official in here and told me that you had $100 a day job insurance. Did too. $100 a day job insurance.
When something would happen, they'd always fire everybody in sight.
Yeah.
Sort it out later.
One time they fired George Driscoll, and he was 25 cars away from where this happened. And I came in, and Mr. Roberts was the big wheel. His private car was sitting there, so I knew that he was a lodge brother of mine. Of course, him and I weren't buddies or anything, but I knew that he was. So I just went in there, and he said, "What? Anything I can do for you, Dave?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Why don't you put George Driscoll back to work?" I said, "You fired him when he's 95 cars away from where this run through that switch and whatnot." I said, "How in the hell can you do that?" And he said, "Oh, it's easy." I said, "Yeah, but," I said, "is it fair?" And he said, "Now I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to put him back to work in 10 days. Now you get out of here." "Now you get out of here." And he said, "And if anybody asks me if it was you in here, I'm going to tell them no." But they put him back to work. But he'd have been off long there if I hadn't went in. And,
yeah. When I entered,
railroad men are pretty good on the helping out people. But I can't remember just too much about that.
They had a flashlight.
Yes, just lived off the side of the track there, that between the Enterprise and Joseph. And then she's standing there, you go up there, and it'd be dark. We was going up, and there would be a little light in the window, waving the light at us. And I got to talking, and it was Christmas time, and I was talking to Laverne Draper and I, and I said, "So why don't we buy her a present? And she said, "All right." So we went in, and there was a beautiful doll. Oh, it was a big doll, all beautiful dress, but it was expensive. And I said, "We'll buy that one." And he said, "Well, what are them the other guys going to say?" I said, "They make big money." I said, "Ain't going to hurt them anyway." I said, we'll do it." And I said, "Well," he said, "if they want pay, we'll do it." And I said, "Okay." So we bought the big doll and went back and put the arm on the rest of them and made them pay. And we pulled up there, we got off, and then I went over and give this little girl the beautiful doll. Now, as you said, she was 50 years old now. She must be about, she was a little girl then. Maybe she was, 7 or 8.
She still has the doll, the way I understand.
Oh, does she?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she was a cute little doll. Always give us the highball when you go by at night.
Well, what a nice thing to do.
Yeah. Ended Duncan, and I was waiting for a helper. I was going to help a train. I was on this helper, and I had three of those big jacks. And the fellow was pulling some stumps out, and he had a big cable there, and it was a team of horses. So right up the track, I said, "Hook that cable around that stump, and I'll pull it out for you." He couldn't pull it out with a horse. "Oh," he said, "I don't know where you could pull it or not." I said, "Oh, my Lord." Put a chain on it, or a cable around it. I pulled about 7 or 8 of them stumps for him. And no problem either, you know. And he was amazed, you know. Another time they put a car off the end of the track at the basis mill at Willow. And they couldn't get it back on. They took 2 D8 cats down there and hooked onto it, and they couldn't pull it back up. So they just wanted to see if we could pull that car up. I said, "I pull it up there, yeah." But we was going to have a big train out, and I had three of those big diesel engines all hooked together, you know. So I pulled down there, and as I pulled down, I sanded the rail, and they put the cable around this car, and it was all ready, and I sucked it right out of there and up on the track, and those guys was amazed that they couldn't pull it out with a couple of cats. They had no idea what three of those big engines would do, you know. And I didn't even open up the throttle hardly, only about the third throttle notch, and just sucked them right out of there. Yeah, very amazing. Oh, yeah. Well, we had, if you had a coal-fired engine, you'd pile a bunch of coal up in the gangway, and as you went by these houses down there, but close to the track, you'd kick the coal off, and the women would be out there with buckets to pick up the coal. Times was pretty rough then, you know, and anyway, it kept warm. And
helped a lot of people out.
Yeah, all you could. And if you happen to, fusee happened to fly off of you, out of your hand or waist or something, and it lights some fires along. I figured if they'd, you know, they have to call out the men and pay them to fight these fires. Times were pretty darn tough. And so you might put some men to work. And they had a Greek section for him. Pete Kouteris was his name. And Pete was different. And one time there was a railroad detective. They called him Red. And he got killed there at Hilgard. Maybe you heard about it.
No, I didn't.
They shot him off. Somebody shot him off of a car there. And Pete Kouteris went down to the phone and he says, grabbed the phone and he says, "Mr. Dispatch, a dead bull on the track." Well, the dispatcher thought it was an animal, see? And finally somebody went to the phone and told him that he'd hold everything. They was...
railroad detective?
Yeah, railroad detective shot. And that's one thing for Pete Kouteris. And another time, there was a big rock come off the track. It was as big as an automobile and lit right in the track. And that was down below Meacham. And Pete, he wouldn't let anybody else to do it. He had to be the big wheel that done all the talking, you know, on the phone. Yeah, he says, "Mr. Dispatcher, a big rock on the track," and hung up. Well, the dispatcher put all the signals red. He didn't know where the hell it was at there, you know. On that end, he put everything red. Finally, they woke up the fact of where it was, and they had to go down there, and I think they had to put some, blast some of it, and break it, and get it off of there. But that was Pete. He big rock on the track. Yeah.
You were telling me, pulled out at Duncan?
Oh, yeah. There's a section cruise down there, and they was trying to get coal, and they wasn't getting it, and so I'd talk to the section guy down there, and they was grabbing about it. Well, we was coming back up, and we had a car of coal right behind the engine. A dandy load of coal. And I said to the brakeman, I said, "You know," I said, "that wheels are running hot on that car back there. We better set it out here." So I said, we set it out. I always wondered how many ton of coal was missing when they got ready to leave it, take it out of there.
But they always, most generally, furnished the section.
Oh, they, yeah, they furnished it. But
and the signal maintainers with coal and ice during the summer.
Yeah, but sometimes it's pretty slow about getting it to them.
Yeah.
Another time I thought maybe I almost got fired, but we had a train master. He was a stupid little jerk. His uncle or somebody must have been a big wheel in the railroad or he never got a job. The roadmaster asked me if I would pick up two women that was at Meacham. They'd bought groceries and they had to get down to Huron. There wasn't any, couldn't run a car up and down, or an old rig at all. There was must have been 5-6 feet of snow in there. Well, I said, sure. So I struck with the light engine. We were going to go over to help a train. So I stopped it, and the fireman and I helped the women load their groceries on the engine, and course he got in, and I took him down to urine and let him off, and the husbands come out there, and they took the groceries off. And so I got in, and I had notified to go up to his office, train master's office. I went up there, and he asked me, what the hell was I doing, running the passenger service? I said, no. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, he said, you picked up two women at Meacham, didn't you? I said, yes, I did. I said, I picked up their groceries, too. He said, that's illegal. You can't do that. And I said, well, it's already dead. I said, those are section men's wives. And I said, the tools that them guys work with wouldn't fit your hand because it's their tool to the hand of for a man. And I was mad. I thought probably I'd get fired. Didn't. So he said, I'm going to see how many demerits you can get. And the big wheel at Portland told him, forget it. He said, you can't do that. Of course, he hauled up. He was asked if he would. That little things that was picky about. But that was a good job. Later, especially when I was at holding a regular job in these big diesels. And got so you went by a steam engine, you rolled the wind up, you didn't want to smell it. It was good heaters, good windshield wipers, good lights, you know. And the radios, especially on the Idaho, there's so much fog over there.
When you were
winter time. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Just like looking through a wet blanket. Well, that's when you talk to your dispatcher. And they were real good about it, too. You said, tell them, we are real foggy. You're going to meet a train at so-and-so. And I'm going to head you in the passenger. I realized the engineer didn't dare miss a signal. That's the only reason why where you knew where you was at, because you knew all those signals. If you missed a signal, you didn't know where he was at. You couldn't see. So we was very careful to watch it all, just get in. Some of the crew would go to bed and go to sleep. The engineer was a guy that usually set up an hour or two after he got in to kind of let down. So, yeah, he was right on edge.
Well, like you said, you're hot
when
you'd see some of these almost accidents. And you wondered if you hit somebody, and there wasn't a thing in the world you could do about it.
Nothing.
And it kind of played on you.
Just were awfully good about talking to you. And if you knew who was ahead of you, like if you was following a train, you listened very carefully because you wanted to hear what he was saying. But that way sometimes you found out just where he was at. And like I said, you didn't dare miss a signal. And that's when you'd yell at the brakeman. He didn't have any firm. Yell at the brakeman. You watch for that signal over there. Keep yelling at him. Afraid you'd miss one.
They had
three brakemen and a conductor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they had a flagman. Swing brakeman, that would be and the head brakeman. Brakeman rode up the engine. And if you had to set like a car or two out, he did it alone. If there's going to be a lot of switching, the swing guy would walk up and do it. Ordinarily, though, most of the time you'd have a lot of habits, you'd have it done.
When you worked on a helper, then the fireman had to get out.
The fireman got the switches. And
because it was just the engineer and
the
fireman out there when helper was working.
That's right. The way it was. The fireman, if they had to get the switch or anything, the fireman did it. The brakeman was out there. If he's in the rear of the train, the conductor and brakeman was out there to hook you up. Yeah. But they've got a stool pigeon on the rear of that train, you know, that tells them, oh, there's a broken rail or anything else on the track.
The stool pigeon, how does that work?
Well, it's I don't know, because it was just starting to get that when I retired. But I really don't know.
But it was a mechanical device.
Yeah,
that,
it's a
gave out a signal.
Red light and a signal, and it probably worked part of the time. Yeah.
Was there anything else that you would rather have done?
Oh, when I was a kid, you didn't have all these chances to go to college that your dad had, the finances and everything ready, so you didn't get that schooling where you'd like to have been. I would have liked to have been a lawyer.
No?
But that wasn't impossible, because like I said, if you got through high school, you was doing good. And I did. But there's no way in the Depression, unless your folks was wealthy people, that you got to went to school. They didn't pay you to go to school then. You didn't borrow the money from the government to go to school on and stuff like that. That was a different proposition.
Your family had to have it?
Outside of that, the railroad was what I'd rather have done. Very fascinating, railroad fascinating. All those cars can come from different places and different railroads, and it's amazing if you look at the concept of a train's made up. And maybe some of those big trains now, you may have 120, 130 cars. And just think where all those cars are out of every place.
And that 120 cars would be how long?
Oh, a mile and a quarter or further, yeah.
Yeah.
Way back there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Got so that some of the passing tracks wouldn't hold those big trains like that. It wasn't room enough, so that usually hold some short train for a big train like that to get by. Or if you didn't, why then you saw it by, and that's when the shorter train pulled up in the pass on up clear of the main line, and then opened the switch back in and you pulled them on through. That's the way that was done. But we were lucky, because most of the time there were several tracks would hold a hell of a lot of cars. A Durkee would hold a string of cars. In other words, it was B2 passing trucks, you might say. And it would hold those big trains. Cassett. You get in with 100 cars, it's crowded. Yeah.
What did you think when they changed over?
The wonderful thing that there was, because those train orders was a pain. You know, you got train orders. X-38 meets X-so-and-so, this place, that place, and things like that, and you had to watch your time card all the time, because on the passenger trains running, you had to clear those passenger trains. And it was just a lot more thinking than working at it than when you central train control, that was the dispatcher.
We took, 27 sidetracks out between LeGrand and Huntington?
Yes, right.
You know, it wouldn't have been too much to have had double track.
No. They're getting a lot of double track anymore, I guess. I don't know what they've done on the mountain. Or do you know what they've done on the mountain?
No, I don't.
Fuel guard. Yes. You know, 40, 50 years ago, I heard they was going to run a tunnel to Huron. And I heard that again, you know, a few years ago, just before I quit, what they was going to do. And then later on, I told the guys, I said, I don't get excited about it. I said, they was going to, I heard about that. I said, 30 years ago, they was going to do this. And I said, they haven't done it yet. And I said, I doubt if they will. I said, that's a hell of a tunnel.
Yeah, long way.
Of course, it just saved them a lot of money and a lot of bigger trains and everything, but I don't think they'll ever do it. You know,
you were working when they had the tunnel at Telecast. Yeah.
They tore that out, you know. Took it all out. Yeah, when I was firing steam engines, that was the tunnel was in there, sure bet. Yeah. Darn right. They had a tunnel that between Huntington and Weatherby.
Yeah.
I guess it's still there.
Still there?
Uh-huh. As far as I know, it is. Yeah. That bridge there to below Mitcham?
Uh-huh.
That's quite a sight from, you know. A wooden bridge.
Well.
And then the big jacks, and think of the weight that was on those. Right on by them. Right on. Must have done, they done a real job of bridge work.
Real engineering feat.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like you said earlier in this interview, that the section...
Oh, yes.
And they were important.
The section men and a bunch of these Navajo Indians tamping ties. The railroad, the track was a lot better shape when they had those big gangs like that with a doing it by hand than it does with this much machine that they punch the railroad. They're not near as smooth, near as nice.
Tie gangs, do you?
Oh, yeah. You had to, like I said, you're an extra board if you love to catch a lot of work trains. And they had a Pilot Rock branch, too. And you'd run out to Pilot Rock and get the mill there and get material. Also, that they had a, you'd go down to Robinette from Huntington down there. I remember that. For pieces that he used to haul out of there sometime, yeah.
Yeah.
A hat full of them. A suitcase practically full, you know.
How far did that line run down there?
Oh, I don't know. Cornucopia?
I've come there along the river.
You can drive now, you know. You can drive down there. You can drive clear to Bristlet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the railroad track used to run.
Kind of narrow, isn't it, if you meet somebody?
Oh, not too bad.
Oh.
It's a gravel, dirt, gravel road. It's not too bad. There's places you, of course, a lot of trailers and big campers and motorhomes and stuff. Drive all that fast anyway.
True.
You know. It was right by the river.
Yeah.
1976, when I was 60 years old.
So you were working during the time of the flood in 1965.
Oh, you bet. I was the first train over that hill when they first got that big train, too. They wouldn't run a little, and they run the big train. And I remember lots of them, the track was 5 miles an hour. And I just tried to hold 6,000 to 7,000 ton. It was tricky. And I got me a Gibbon and told me to go in there and get something to eat. And went in the car and they had a cook in there, regular. And we ate. And they said, you'll have to haul crews. So we'd go back, take the engine back up the river and meet some creek and pick up crews and take the fresh crews back up until we just give us time to hook a train and get down to Hinkle. And it was down there. He outranked all the officials too. And they were laying that, doing that. He asked me how long would it take me to go to Hinkle, and I told him. He said, "Well, we'll let you go then, but you haul crews. Anytime you want coffee, you want something to eat," he said, "go and do it." He said, "The radio's all hooked up, so they'll notify you." So I know we all went in and had steak dinner. And later on, before we left, I went in and had some coffee. Yeah.
You remember Buck Daniels, second?
Yeah, quite a guy. Buck was quite a guy. Yeah, I remember a maintainer. His name was Stiles, but I can't remember his first name.
Jess Stiles.
Jess Stiles. I couldn't remember his name. Isn't that awful?
Well, not necessarily.
I knew the man, too. He gave me signal oil one time because I was used to do a lot of hunting and shooting and everything. The greatest oil for a rifle oil that you ever seen because you couldn't freeze it up.
Uh-huh.
It's signal oil.
Yeah.
He gave me a bottle of that, a little bottle of it, several times.
The story about Jess Stiles is, I think, fantastic. And his wife paid for that house.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Their money, too.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah, I've heard guys making more remarks about it because those dead beasts and everything, them guys earned their money.
They were out there
any time of the day or night, whether it was warm, cold, or whatnot.
Every time a rock hit the rock fence out there and they pulled it out, they were out there in the cold.
Yeah.
With nothing but a little speeder.
But those rock fences was really a great thing.
I bet they were.
See, they just, when that knocked that fence out, it threw the signals.
Mm-hmm.
Use the block signals to go red. So you stopped.
Yeah.
And that's why they was there, and it was really a great thing.
In the winter time, when Harry Hewitt's men got out there and pulling.
Oh, yeah. Hewitt, that was the foreman, section foreman.
The telecast.
Yeah, and later on, I think he got down to Union Junction.
Yeah. Lily was down there for a while.
Yeah. Hewitt, I knew who Hewitt.
Oh, with Crooks and Sagal, putting heaters under switches to keep the snow out.
Oh. That was a wonderful thing, too, because they were automatically, they could relight those, the dispatcher could relight those automatically, those
propane. Yeah, when they put
propane.
They're propane.
Yeah.
In the days when you put the old
but sometimes,
kerosene.
Sometimes you'd have to tell him to.
Yeah.
Because I know I used to call a dispatcher, they dispatch. And how are those signals up there? You suppose they're froze up at Meacham or where I was going to go up there? No, I think they'll be all right. That's when he turned them on, see. My brother-in-law was a dispatcher, Ray Wilson.
Isn't he?
Yeah, Thompson. He ended up in Nampa.
Nampa. In Felix Cravallo.
Oh, Felix is here now.
Yeah.
He lives here.
He's retired. And,
old timer.
Yeah.
He was the
chief dispatcher.
Right, he was the chief dispatcher. And another old guy there was it.
Lefebvre?
Old Dave Lefebvre, do better later. I nicknamed him that because he was asking him about how long are you going to be in here? What's going to take place here? Well, you'll want to be there soon, but I'll tell you what, he said, I can do better later, so I got to call him do better later. But we did have good dispatchers, and that Indian, that Thompson,
mm-hmm.
I knew him when we were little boys.
Is that right?
I knew his dad, Dolph Thompson. That Indian was the best dispatcher that's ever been on this railroad.
He was good.
He had nerve, and he knew his engineers. He knew that he was going to make it.
And everybody respected him.
Oh, yes, sure. And Glenn Thompson.
Yep.
Yeah. Thompson, he was a... They ran a store down there at Gibbon for a while.
Oh.
Well, I think his dad had cattle and stock, too, and I think he was financially pretty well fixed.
Well, Eldon?
Oh, yeah,
also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Eldon's a good guy. I was trying to make sure that it worked out he worked there in the Borden Chemical.
Oh, Wayne Drummond.
Wayne Drummond. Yeah, good guy too.
No, good.
Hmm?
I say good.
Yeah, he was.
He lives next door to me.
He was, him and the Thompson were great cronies.
Yes.
Great friends. Yeah, Wayne Drummond, good guy. I like Wayne. Yeah.
Well, we all three hunted together.
Yeah. I know he was. He loved that old 300 H&H Magnum. I went moose hunting, you know.
You did?
Oh, yeah. killed a big moose.
Oh.
This was in cool. My son was in college, and my daughter was, I think, a senior in high school. And I'm going to take that hunting trip. She said, go ahead. I said, you know, it's going to cost probably more than $1,000. She said, go ahead. A plane off of Stewart Lake. We went to Fort James, and that's an Indian village. And we took a float plane off of Stewart Lake and flew back north into Gresham Lake. Yeah.
And she did it once?
Yeah, it was all I cared about. All over.
All over.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In the Starkey area?
Oh, yeah, a lot of in that Starkey area. Remember Jim Ridge and Park Saddle and the Beaver, Dry Beaver. And
up to the old Beaver Tower.
Oh, yeah, all over that country. Went old Winter's place and clear through all that. Elkhorn and, four-wheel drive rigs. Ever since I got out of this Army, I had to get me a Jeep, right away. I passed away in 1995. I've lived alone. Well, it's kind of lonesome sometimes,
That's great.
Yeah. She's just a fine guy in the world and great girl. Trust me when I say that. He is a marvelous guy.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, I think the world of him. I think that was just the old store. It was up there at Starkey. And in those days, Tony Vey had a lot of cattle on the sheep ranch.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, that's what they called it those days, sheep ranch. They called it Tony's Meadows now, but when I was a kid and a young fella, we all called it sheep ranch. And I know that Tony's dad, Anton Vey, boy, I like Tony because when they used to bring the cattle in and they'd stay at the Starkey store overnight when they used to bring the cattle out. And I like Tony because he was always, you meet Tony, you'd say, Dave, how's your mother? They knew my folks, my dad and mother. And I think so. We were on the Sullivan place. And Andy Sullivan's dad took that place over. And I know that he had cattle, loved good horses. He didn't like cayuses.
Oh. Cayuses were Indian horses.
I remember we had Indian. The government put out a stallion to breed up the sort because they used a lot of horses. The Army did though, so they put out this great, old, beautiful stallion, Bugard. And you were for a long time. Quite a few of the Talls.
Wes. Winnie. Lester.
Les Tiles. Jess Blunkett. Jack Stario. Sean Wells. Alan Thomas. Now, they lived up there. Those people I'm naming. The Hagees.
Yeah. You're the Hagees.
Mail carrier when I was a kid. And a team and wagon. A lot of them are gone now. Those guys that I used to work with and guys that hired out when I did, they're gone. Harold Hillary was gone.
Yeah.
He died here a couple of weeks ago, I guess. I had felt really bad about that. Harold and I were friends for 65 years. All gonna go, My daughter don't like to hear me say those things. I told her I'd had my funeral and raped my soul. I don't want to hear about it. But I said, well, you might better listen. Because, by the way, this is a marvelous country.
Oh.
This is a marvelous country. And I have had a wonderful life. I had a good family, a good home, a good job. And I treated it well, right. And I had a wonderful life.
The weather,
we had
real
winters.
Winters, but it's
But
changed.
Yeah, but I was young then. Harlem winters didn't hate them near as bad like I do now. It was just a little down to zero now. God, I think it's terrible.
Think how much warmer now that we are than we were in the old days.
Oh yeah. And how much better off we are now. Here, last year I got to worrying about the furnace. I got a big forced air furnace in the basement. Got to worrying about it. It was 45 years old. Well, you pick up the phone, told them to come up, put me in a new one.
Yeah.
Now I didn't have to worry about it. But I was worried about it because I guess when you get old, you worry about things.
Well, when you come back to work for the railroad in 1940, and you $1,000, $3,000, you can buy most anything in town.
Well, let me tell you, that's where I made a mistake. I could have bought a beautiful home one time for little or nothing. And I just laughed and said, I don't want to, what do I want to be saddled with something to pay taxes on? At the bank. Mr. Lumsden, Treve Lumsden, Dr. Lumsden's dad was the manager.
Uh-huh, I remember him.
Do you remember him, yeah. And that night I said, I think I had $700 or $800. I said, no, I don't want nothing like that. When I bought this place here in 1950, I paid $7,500 for it. Now it's worth $100,000. Of course, I got another house in the back, a little cottage in the back. Now it's worth, I suppose, $100,000 or more. I don't know, but like I used to. But I'm having a new steel roof put on both my houses. In fact, they've ordered the metal now, and that's now I got to pay for it, I suppose. And then I never had to done it again, see.
True.
But I wouldn't spend that much money, see.
Well, you know, you were cautious. Because you know,
I was a depression kid.
Yeah.
Although I can't truthfully say that I suffered very much because my dad was a farmer.
Yeah.
And they had lots of hogs, chickens, and they had beef cattle, big gardens.
Yeah.
And they both knew how to handle things. But I remember when, if you ever give me a dollar, it was as big as a wagon wheel. You remember those days, or?